schools and stadiums have been converted to makeshift homeless shelters. And once again, the twin earthquakes of nature and poverty have taken their toll, with the ramshackle housing of the poor often built on hillsides, leading to disproportionate deaths. After an unusual closed-door session in Washington, D.C., the U.S. Senate becomes a court of impeachment again today. Senators met for 4.5 hours last night, beyond the view of cameras and the public, to debate a motion to dismiss the charges against President Clinton. Today, the focus is likely to be on witnesses, with House prosecutors expected to formally present their proposed witness list. After arguments by House managers and the White House legal team, the Senate may again move to a closed-door session on a motion to call witnesses. Votes on the two motions may not come until tomorrow. Meanwhile, more and more senators from both parties are calling for an end to the trial. Senate Republican leaders are seriously considering a proposal by Susan Collins, a Republican of Maine, to allow the Senate to convict the president but not remove him from office. Monica Lewinsky, who tried unsuccessfully over the weekend to avoid an interview with House Republicans managing the Senate impeachment trial of President Clinton, has been seeking court clearance to tell her story to ABC's Barbara Walters. Lewinsky's lawyers have petitioned for a hearing Thursday to try to force independent counsel Kenneth Starr to lift restrictions on what she may discuss publicly, including in a planned interview with Walters on ABC's 2020 news program. Under the terms of Lewinsky's immunity agreement with Starr, she may not make statements to the news media without approval of the independent counsel, quote, pending a final resolution of this matter. When that may be is unclear, and Lewinsky appears to have grown tired waiting. The motion that prompted Thursday's hearing is under seal, however, and lawyers for neither Starr nor Lewinsky would comment. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is trying to ease recently strained relations between Russia and the United States. Albright told Russian President Boris Yeltsin today in Moscow that they shouldn't let small differences on key issues spoil the relationship. Albright spoke with Yeltsin by phone because he's in the hospital for treatment of an ulcer. Recent declarations by Albright and other U.S. officials have alarmed the Russians that the anti-ballistic missile treaty is doomed. But Albright assured Yeltsin the U.S. remains committed to the agreement, which bans a national defense against missiles. President Clinton has proposed pouring $6 billion into a Star Wars program. Albright is also meeting today with Russia's foreign minister, is expected to discuss Kosovo and Iraq. The U.S. continues to pound Iraq with missiles today. The U.S. Air Force said today U.S. jets had fired at 3 Iraqi targets in the northern no-fly zone. Meanwhile, Pentagon officials admitted last night that U.S. warplanes may have misfired yesterday during their continued attacks over the south of Iraq, hitting a civilian neighborhood in Basra. CNN reports that the missile killed at least 11 civilians and wounded more than 50 others. This admission comes after State Department spokesperson James Foley yesterday said reports of the bombing of a civilian neighborhood were Iraqi propaganda, and the Pentagon said it had no knowledge of the missile attack. General Anthony Zinni, commander of U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf, told reporters at the Pentagon, quote, "We deeply regret any loss of civilian lives or civilian casualties or injuries. Secondly, we do everything humanly possible to prevent that. And thirdly, most important, the ultimate reason and cause for these casualties is Saddam Hussein." The general said it was premature to consider whether an official apology would be appropriate, adding the U.S. will continue its air raids. Meanwhile, the government of Kuwait says the U.S. has sent 8 F-16 warplanes. It is not often John Pope Paul travels abroad and meets a head of state on trial, but today the Pope begins private talks with President Clinton in St. Louis. In the meeting, the Pope is expected to make direct reference to the stance towards Iraq, in particular last month's airstrikes and the devastating U.S.-led U.N. sanctions imposed in 1990. And the Pope has already made clear his opposition to U.S. policies toward Iraq. He described last month's air raids as a breach of international law, and the Vatican issued a statement condemning the attacks as aggression. As for the sanctions, the Pope has called them pitiless and has said that food and medicine should not be used as weapons of war. The Pope is also expected to speak out against the death penalty, this following a year in which the United States executed its 500th person since capital punishment resumed in 1977. Meanwhile, the Archdiocese of St. Louis has begun offering homebuyers $5,000 if they settle in one of three racially diverse Southside neighborhoods in an unusual, possibly unprecedented effort to lure Catholics back to the city. Pope John Paul II will visit the city beginning today. And that's some of the news. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. R.W. Apple had an interesting piece in the front page of the New York Times today called Hurt Feelings and Maneuvering Before Senate Takes Crucial Vote. He writes, "With doors closed to the public and television cameras switched off, the Senate last night debated whether to dismiss all charges against President Clinton and bring his impeachment trial to an end. The debate began after a bid by two Democrats to override the rules and hold the debate in public view failed to muster the two-thirds vote required or even a simple majority. The move was voted down 43-57, with most Republicans favoring a secret session and most Democrats an open session. After 4.5 hours of debate, the Senate adjourned a few moments before 10 p.m. last night. At least at first, none of the senators was willing to characterize their exchanges. In the modern era, closed sessions are normally held only when classified information is discussed. The last one in the Senate was to allow a debate on the Chemical Weapons Convention on April 24, 1997. But the rules governing impeachment trials date from the mid-19th century, when senators were not yet directly elected, when the notion of open government had no great popular appeal, and when, of course, radio and television had not been invented. We turn right now to a number of senators I got a chance to talk to last night when I went over to the Senate. Some Democrats were furious that the debate was not open. Two of them was Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone and Iowa Democrat Tom Harkin. We begin with Wellstone, but listen carefully because it's very noisy in the corridors of the Senate.
I think it's it was a huge mistake, and you know, I have a real sense of outrage about it. You would think that when the Senate goes into deliberations of whether or not you're going to remove a president from office or whether charges would be dismissed, this would be an open, publicly accountable debate. It won't be. It'll be behind closed doors. That's unconscionable.
And that's Senator Wellstone. He just finished with a news conference.
Just for deposition.
Senator Harkin, we're on a live national show. Can you tell us how you answer the charge that this is actually, you're a jury. Jury should deliberate in secret.
Well, as I have pointed out, I made a point, and the Chief Justice upheld my objection.
Senator Harkin is known for having stood up to Rehnquist, and this was an agreement that Rehnquist approved, saying that they, senators, are not jurors.
Of impeachment. We decide not only facts, but law. We can decide what witnesses we want to call. We can decide whether something's in the national interest. We have very broad, expansive powers. So in no way, shape, or form are we a jury. We are a court of impeachment. And as that court of impeachment, paid for by the taxpayers of this country, I believe we have an obligation to conduct it in open session so that the people know how and why we reach the decisions we do.
What will happen to a senator who reveals what happens in that closed-door session?
That senator is liable to expulsion from the Senate.
Senator Harkin, Senator Wellstone, thank you very much for being with us. They have just run off to participate in the closed-door session where they will debate the issue of dismissal of the case. I then got a chance to talk with Senator Lugar, Senator Richard Lugar, the Republican from Indiana. He, too, was headed to the closed-door session. Senator Lugar, this is a national program. I'm wondering if you could say why you voted for a closed debate rather than an open one.
Well, we've had an age-old rule that there would be closed debate when senators visit with each other on these subjects. And as a practical matter, this is a subject in Iowa whether to end the trial or not, in which almost all senators have taken public views, so there is nothing particularly secretive about it, and we will all vote publicly on the issue. My own view as a practical matter, if we had not gone on a closed session tonight, each senator would have demanded his or her 10 minutes, that is 1,000 minutes, 16 hours, And that's just a regular debate, not taking time for recesses or what have you. So that would have prolonged, I believe, the trial for 2 days, maybe three, at the rate that we are proceeding. It seemed to me that we can conclude whatever discussion senators have with each other this evening in this manner and without having the imposition of the 10-minute rule.
But Senator Lugar, this is one of the most important votes in the history of this country, the whole issue of whether to remove a president. Why are we talking about a number of minutes? Why shouldn't the American people hear what each senator has to say on the issue of whether this case should be dismissed?
Well, each senator can tell you over this program or wherever he or she wants to tell it right now precisely what they're going to do. Can give a 10-minute speech publicly. Most of us have already. All I'm saying is the actual votes on the issue will be quite public. We'll be standing behind our desks and giving the vote in full view of C-SPAN and the regular press, and that'll be true of each vote that we take. No votes are going to be in closed session.
But certainly you debate on less important issues. We, as the American people, the issue is whether we get to see what it is, why you vote the way you do. What about the issue of Article 29 that says that if you even reveal to us what you or other senators say, you could be expelled as a senator?
Well, Article 29 preserves the confidentiality of the session. Clearly, there would not be value in having a closed session if senators immediately went outside the session and went verbatim into what was said. So that, it seems to me, is a logical consequence of having a closed session.
But why should your rationale be secret? Yes, we know your vote, but why should your rationale as to whether this case should be dismissed be secret from the American people? We will never even see a transcript.
Well, I have no really further argument as to why all of what we do should not be public. By and large, I think that it ought to be. All I'm saying is in this particular instance this evening, it appeared to a large majority of us that there was no particular reason to change the rule. And the rule is that we ought to have closed sessions when senators want to go into debate. This is a trial. Normally, in a trial by jury in a regular courtroom, the jury does not conduct a debate in the midst of the trial.
But Chief Justice Rehnquist himself ruled that you are not just regular jurors.
Of course, and so that confuses the issue even further. But most people believe we are jurors. Most of us believe we are. We look very much like jurors, and jurors try to comport themselves in ways that people who are trying to find impartial justice do not get into vigorous public debates. Now, I grant you that many of our colleagues have been debating on television, on radio, with the press, been an endless stream of debate, and fair enough. They have to make judgments on their own. But I would just simply say, as a matter of official proceeding, the jury or the jury and judges, if we are both, ought not to be having public debates.
Finally, Senator Lugar, your position on subpoenaing witnesses.
I want to listen carefully to debate on that. My general feeling is that the House and the President ought to have the right to call witnesses if they believe that that will be helpful to their cases. Those witnesses will be heard publicly, so the public will hear the same thing we do as the jury or judges, as the case may be. And I'm inclined to give the benefit of the doubt. But our first judgment will be to whether we have any witnesses at all. And if we do, the list then will be deposed, which means that the witnesses will be quizzed by both sides to see whether they have anything new or anything relevant to say. And then we'll have to have an up or down vote on each witness before hearing them in public.
Thank you very much, Republican Senator Lugar.
That is Indiana Republican Senator Richard Lugar and his way to the secret debate that the Senate conducted until about 10 o'clock last night on the issue of dismissal of the counts. The dismissal motion of Senator Robert Byrd, the Democrat of West Virginia. The Senate is expected to vote on the dismissal motion today or tomorrow with only a simple majority required for approval. Few predict it'll pass, but Robert Byrd, the sponsor of the measure, and his allies hope to get 40 or more votes to demonstrate
fairly definitively that the two-thirds vote required for conviction of President Clinton is beyond the reach of the prosecution. We now turn to Asa Hutchinson. He's one of the 13 House managers. He's the Republican from Arkansas and one of the three House managers, along with Ed Bryan of Tennessee and Bill McCollum of Florida, who met with Monica Lewinsky this weekend at the Mayflower Hotel.
Congressman Hutchinson, can I ask you a quick question? This is for radio. Can I ask you, what did you get out of the interview yesterday with Monica Lewinsky?
Well, you have to evaluate the witnesses to determine whether you're going to make the recommendation of the Senate that she be called or any other witness be called. So it's an introductory meeting. I believe in meeting the witnesses eye to eye when you can. And we did. She's a very impressive lady. She had a lot of poise. She's obviously intelligent, and I think she'd make a good witness in this trial, then would prove to be very helpful to the Senate, and they're trying to determine the truth in this case.
What's your comment on what she said to a friend, according to the New York Times? I didn't give them anything.
Well, you know, our goal was not to go in there and learn all kinds of new facts. There were some areas that we did want to cover, and we did. But primarily was to evaluate her as a witness, and we were certainly satisfied with that. I think that obviously when she's been questioned numerous times by the grand jury, that most of the facts are out there. But there's areas that probably would be relevant to probe into that have not been inquired about. And we're going to make that presentation tomorrow on the in the U.S. Senate floor and make the case for calling her.
Did you ask her about the gifts, whether Betty Curry called her to pick up the gifts?
I don't want to get into the substance and the areas that we talked to her about, because we had an agreement with her counsel that we would not do that and just talk about the description of the meeting.
If you do call her as a witness, will you go to one of the issues of perjury that President Clinton has been charged with, him saying he did not touch her breast?
Now, I would expect that the perjury allegations that she would have knowledge about are clearly established in the transcript record, in her grand jury testimony, and so I would expect that we would not get into that at all. And I think that's important for the Senate and for her personally. And we would talk about the obstruction of justice charges, the information she would have in relation to that.
And what is your comment on your fellow House manager, Lindsey Graham, saying reasonable people could disagree on this, as well as the idea that you could vote to convict President Clinton but not remove him?
Well, you know, on the first thing, you know, Lindsey Graham was asked a very tough question on the spur of the moment on the floor of the Senate. And all the managers believe strongly in this case that obstruction of justice occurred, that we have the facts and the proof to substantiate that, as well as perjury. Now, I believe in this case, but I'm leaving this outcome to the United States Senate and their discretion. My burden is not to determine the outcome, but to present the case in a fair manner. And so, you know, that's my view on it.
And last question, Speaker Gingrich, when he got in trouble and had to pay $300,000 because of violations of ethics, where did you stand on that? A lot of questions about his credibility and whether he, too, told the truth.
Well, I think that that is a recommendation from the Bipartisan Ethics Committee as to the disposition of that case, and it was not dealing with statements under oath in a judicial proceeding. This is discussions in a body of the House over the conduct of its own members, and so it's a totally different circumstance, and you really can't make any comparison, because those statements were not under oath and were not perjurious, and it was a bipartisan recommendation from the committee.
Did you vote to reelect him as House Speaker?
Yes, I did.
Thank you very much.
And that is Arkansas Republican Congressmember Asa Hutchinson, one of the 13 House managers who are prosecuting President Clinton in the Senate impeachment trial. And this little historical note, in late December 1996, the Ethics Subcommittee investigating Newt Gingrich issued a 22-page statement of alleged violations and released Gingrich's own admission that he violated House rules. The subcommittee's statement described how tax-exempt money was used for political purposes and said that Gingrich provided the panel in December 94 and March 95 information that he should have known was, quote, inaccurate, incomplete, and unreliable. Gingrich admitted he submitted false information to the panel. In January 1997, Gingrich became the first Republican reelected speaker in 68 years. And I'd love to hear what questions you'd like to ask senators or House managers. You can email them to us at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Or you can call our comment line at 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. Coming up, we'll look at the wars in Angola and Sierra Leone. And then, how is it that a corporation has bought the entire gene data bank of Iceland? Stay with us. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Government forces fighting to regain the upper hand in Angola's month-old renewal of civil war shelled rebel UNITA positions outside the northern city of Malanje today. This according to a senior commander. The commander said as heavy artillery fire echoed across the city, "We want to push them, UNITA, out of the region. They do not stand a chance. We're much more powerful." We now go to the oil, gold, and diamond-rich but yet impoverished country of Angola, where a renewed civil war has shattered the four-year-old peace accord between the government and the rebel force UNITA. Fighting continues between the government forces and UNITA as UN Secretary General Kofi Annan tries to close down the UN observer mission in Angola. You may remember that UNITA is the rebel force headed by Savimbi, which was backed by the apartheid-era South Africa, as well as the U.S. government. We now turn to Jeremy Cronin, who is Deputy Secretary General of the South African Communist Party and National Executive Member of the African National Congress. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy Cronin.
Hello, Amy. Thank you very much.
Well, it's good to be with you. Can you explain what's happening right now in Angola?
Well, as you correctly said in the introduction, we're seeing the descent once more into full-scale civil war in a country that really hasn't seen for the last three decades and more any enduring peace whatsoever. I think it's probably wrong to say a shattering of the peace accord that goes back to 1994, the so-called Lusaka Protocol, in which UNITA and the governing MPLA signed a peace accord indeed, because that peace accord has never really held whatsoever. The key features of the Lusaka Protocol were that there would be a movement towards a government of national unity, and it would see Savimbi, the rebel leader, UNITA rebel leader, incorporated into government, probably as a vice president. The demilitarization of UNITA and the merging of UNITA forces into a common government force, and above all, the extension of government sovereignty across the full terrain of Angola, something that has never been the case for two decades. UNITA simply has failed to cooperate whatsoever with the terms of that protocol. And although there's been a United Nations observer mission in place, a peacekeeping mission in place, it's been clear to all that UNITA simply flouted all of the key components of the Lusaka Protocol. So what we're seeing unfolding now is sadly the consequence of a peace accord that was never really in place.
What is your interest in this, Jeremy Cronin? You are in South Africa. What is your connection to Angola?
Well, there are many connections to Angola for South Africans. In many respects, the South African transition, democratic transition, began in 1987 with the defeat of UNITA and South African apartheid forces in southern Angola, on the battlefields of southern Angola, by a combined Angolan and Cuban armed forces. And that defeat, which marked really an important change in the balance of conventional armed forces in the whole of southern Africa, it signaled that the apartheid conventional forces were no longer supreme throughout the region. And that resulted quite rapidly in the New York Accords, which led to Namibian independence, and those quite quickly paved the way indeed for the 1990 commencement of the negotiated transition here in South Africa. So I think most South Africans have a profound sense of indebtedness to the Angolan people and an awareness that the wars that were fought in Angola and which have cost so many Angolans their lives, their livelihoods, have had a lot to do with the struggle against apartheid itself.
Can you talk about what oil, gold, and diamonds have to do with UNITA right now?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the question.
Can you talk about what oil, gold, and diamonds have to do with UNITA right now?
Well, basically, what we have in Angola, and perhaps the prime reason why, apart from the obduracy of UNITA, why those peace accords did not stick and why early attempts also to have peace accords have failed in Angola, is that we basically don't have a nation state in Angola. We have two enclave economies. On the one hand, we have the MPLA government, which incidentally won elections, democratic elections, against UNITA in 1992, in power in Luanda, the capital, and controlling basically the western seaboard of Angola. The northwestern seaboard is very rich in oil, and the prime source of revenue for the government in Luanda comes from oil. And incidentally, it's estimated that by the year 2002, some 10% of U.S. oil will be from Angola. So it's not just the future of Angola is not just of interest to South Africans or Southern Africans, but indeed to Americans as well. UNITA has managed to seize control of the northeastern sector of the country, and that's a diamond-rich part of the country. Estimated revenues from diamond sales to UNITA of the order of half a billion U.S. dollars a year. And it's been on the basis of this control of the diamond producing areas that has enabled them to rearm massively in the last few years. And that's why we have a massive civil war on our hands at the moment. UNITA is estimated to have something like 80 modern tanks. It's got U.S. Stinger surface-to-air missiles, which recently brought down two UN aeroplanes. So we have armies that are very well equipped, pitched against each other at the moment.
We're talking to Jeremy Cronin, Deputy Secretary General of the South African Communist Party, National Executive Member of the African National Congress. Also want to ask you a little about South Africa, which we'll do in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue our conversation with Jeremy Cronin for just a few more minutes. Jeremy Cronin, Deputy Secretary General of the South African Communist Party. Are you in Johannesburg now?
Yes, I'm speaking from Johannesburg.
Uh-huh. Wow, what a good line. Okay, in South Africa right now, we've got two news items. One of them is a local head of South Africa's fledgling United Democratic Movement, UDM, shot dead on his doorstep. Police said this yesterday, sparking fears of a link between the violence that shook KwaZulu-Natal province at the weekend. Can you explain what's happened and the significance of this?
Basically, last year, a new political formation was launched. It's called the UDM, the United Democratic Movement. It consists, the two key leaders in that movement are, on the one hand, Bantu Holomisa, an expelled ANC member and a former Transkei Bantustan military leader. He led a coup in the old Bantustan. And Rolf Meyer, the key negotiator from the old apartheid National Party, they, in the course of last year, launched this party, the UDM, in an attempt, from their point of view, to break what they described as the racial logjam of South African politics, meaning that most of the political parties are rooted in one or another racial group. We believe that this particular party involved a number of rather strange and dubious characters, not least the two leaders themselves, who have apartheid military intelligence, military connections from the past. But in particular, the most notorious of the leadership figures within the UDM was an individual called Sifiso Nkabinde, who's been at the heart of a great deal of the violence in the KwaZulu-Natal province. Sifiso Nkabinde was also an ANC member, but certainly, in fact, working for the old apartheid police as an agent provocateur, and was at the center of a lot of difficulties, a lot of problems, and was one of the kinds of individuals who successfully played this role of provocateur and made it very difficult just when peace talks were progressing. It would be a further outbreak of violence and a cycle of violence, and he was certainly behind that. He became the Secretary General of this new movement, the UDM, and he was killed this past weekend, in circumstances which still remain a little bit mysterious. It's not quite clear what lay behind that killing. Some rumors suggest that it was internecine conflict within the UDM movement, but we can't be sure of that. And then, as you correctly report again, there's a story yesterday of another local leader, but in the Western Cape, who was also gunned down, again in circumstances which are not entirely clear. We're obviously all very concerned that this does not mark the beginnings of an upsurge of violence here in South Africa as we move towards elections in the middle of this year. Everyone is very keen to get to the bottom of the violence to ensure that we don't have a spiral of retaliatory violence.
Well, Jeremy Cronin, we want to thank you very much for being with us, and we'll be back with you when the elections do take place in South Africa and President Nelson Mandela steps down as the leader of South Africa. Jeremy Cronin, Deputy Secretary General of the South African Communist Party and National Executive Member of the African National Congress, speaking to us from Johannesburg, South Africa. We're now going to move to another part of Africa. Rebels in Sierra Leone abducted 14 foreigners yesterday, including 11 Indian businessmen and Japan's honorary consul in the capital of Freetown, and two European journalists, as hopes fade for a negotiated end to a brutal civil war. Freetown's been under siege for 2 weeks, deserted by nearly all the international humanitarian organizations as rebels continue their efforts to overthrow the country's president. The rebels stormed into Freetown this past January 6th, seizing eastern and central districts from Nigerian-led regional forces known as ECOMOG. Just this Saturday, when I was taking a taxi to the Senate in Washington, D.C., I was picked up by a man from Sierra Leone who was completely distraught. He and his wife hadn't been able to reach their families in Sierra Leone for a month because all phone lines were cut off. And he was describing to me that one of the tortures that are most common right now in Sierra Leone are the cutting off of hands. And today on the front page of the New York Times is a picture of a man in Connaught Hospital in Freetown, Sierra Leone, after rebels cut off his hands. He said, "I asked them to kill me now," Mohamed Sese remembered, pleading after he was caught by rebels gripping machetes. But they ignored him. They held his hands flat on a tree stump, and he felt the machete fall on one wrist and then the others. This, the rebels told him, is an example to show the president. Hacking off hands and feet of ordinary people has been a key weapon of a widespread campaign of terror and butchery that has been waged by the rebels trying to overthrow the ravaged country's president. We're joined on the phone right now by Yao Graham. He's speaking to us from Accra, Ghana, and he's the editor for Public Agenda and managing editor of the African Agenda. Welcome to Democracy Now, Yao.
Thank you.
Can you tell us, from your vantage point in Ghana, what is happening in Sierra Leone right now?
Well, I mean, as you said, this assault on Freetown was 2 weeks ago, and it's very clear that the ECOMOG troops have not completely regained control of the capital, or if they have, definitely not of its immediate environs. And of course, fighting continues in other parts of the country. And also, it's only now that the first humanitarian flight of any kind have landed in that country. And there's a general humanitarian crisis, including, of course, the atrocities that you mentioned and the internal displacements and so on. We're talking about a country which is completely devastated by 8 years of war.
Can you explain the politics? Who are the rebels? Who is the president?
Well, it's a very complex situation. First of all, we must remember that this rebellion was partly connected to the war in Liberia, because Sierra Leone was part of the initial West African effort which intervened in the Liberian Civil War. And the RUF, the Revolutionary United Front, got some support from the present ruling group in Liberia, that's the National Patriotic Front of Liberia, led by Charles Taylor, and they started their own insurgency. But because it was possible for them to start that insurgency because Sierra Leone, despite its natural riches, is one of the poorest countries in the world. Years of very corrupt and incompetent government under Siaka Stevens, and then later on by Joseph Momo, had left the country ripe for this kind of event, a society which had decomposed, you know, despite, you know, its immense possibilities. And since that time, instability has been the rule. Momo was overthrown by soldiers who briefly settled the war. In that context, Tijankaba was elected, but the peace settlement that was reached by the AFRC military government very quickly unraveled, and then a coup followed, which coup was overthrown by Nigerian troops in April last year, and then the war resumed.
And what kind of information are you getting in Ghana from Sierra Leone, and how aware are people in other parts of Africa about what's going on there? Is it a center of public attention?
Well, certainly in Ghana it is, because there are Ghanaian troops guarding installations in Dungi Airport, and there are Sierra Leonean refugees here. And just yesterday, for example, the UN Special Envoy for Sierra Leone, Mr. Okello, was in Accra for discussion with President Rawlings. And the reports of their discussions were on the front page of the leading daily newspapers in the country. And so Sierra Leone is very much part of the Ghanaian scene. In his sessional address to Parliament last week, the president spoke about Sierra Leone, and on the anniversary of independence of the Republic on the 7th of January, he spoke about Sierra Leone. So it's a very living issue here.
And just to place Sierra Leone for listeners who aren't too familiar with the continent, I mean, we get so little information on Africa. It is in West Africa. It is bordered by Guinea and Liberia. Ghana is two countries away. Is that right, Yael Graham?
That's right.
What do you suggest? What do you think needs to happen right now?
Well, it's very clear that this war cannot be won militarily. Because when the Nigerians went in, they announced very confidently that it was going to be a mere mopping up operation. Now, the fact that, you know, a year later the rebels are able to enter Freetown and hold it for a considerable period, and of course, I don't think they intended to hold it, but simply to show that they have the capacity. Now, I mean, this is not a winnable war. The only people who are suffering are the Sierra Leonean people. The country is getting worse. Now, there are a number of elements here. First of all, there are the internal factors. There's an elected government which clearly has reason not to want to give in to a rebel movement which is carrying out considerable atrocities. And in doing that, of course, weakens whatever popular base it may have. They're not giving a good advert of themselves. Secondly, there is the business of the regional dimensions of the problem, which is the role of the West African countries in trying to bring about a settlement in Sierra Leone. Nigeria is a key player here with these troops. I don't think Nigeria itself can sustain this war for two reasons. Its oil revenue, it has dropped considerably because of the price of oil. Secondly, the internal political situation is not very favorable to this exercise. This thing was initiated by Abacha at the height of his tyranny, so he didn't need any public consensus. Nigeria is in the process of holding elections for transition to an elected government. The question will be asked, what is in this for Nigeria? Beyond preventing the spread of rebellion in the region, I mean, there's very little else that Nigeria has to gain from this, but it's a very expensive exercise. And a civilian government may very well feel that it's better pulling back and concentrating on solving the considerable internal problems that Nigeria has. So there's that problem. And then the international context, despite the pronouncements by many countries of concern about Sierra Leone, there's not much material support coming to the effort of those who are sending troops there. And it is not a sustainable situation for most countries to continue to face a situation where people would die in wars that would be difficult to explain at home. But the containment of Sierra Leone is also important because there are implications for Guinea also, where the situation is not very good. But to get to the bottom of it, there are some further regional dimensions. Burkina Faso is playing a very important role in the training and the arming of these rebels. People skirt around this question. President Blaise Compaoré happens to be the current chair of the OAU. Now, it's a travesty that the OAU chair is actively engaged in fomenting war in another country.
The Organization of African Unity.
Organization of African Unity. Charles Taylor, who is the president of Liberia, neighboring Sierra Leone, is actively engaged. Now, so unless these regional dimensions are openly talked about and all the parties take their place at the table in a way not dissimilar to the efforts being made in Central Africa around the Great Lakes region in relation to the problem in the Congo, that it is not simply an internal problem.
Yao Gram,
internal dimensions.
I want to thank you very much for your explanations. Yao Gram, editor for Public Agenda and managing editor of the African Agenda, speaking to us from Accra, Ghana. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, an amazing story about a corporation buying up the entire gene data bank of a country. The country is Iceland. Stay with us. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This past December, Iceland decided to become the first country in the world to sell the rights to the entire population's genetic code to a biotechnology company. The highly controversial plan will grant exclusive rights to Decode Genetics, a company owned by Roche Holding AG, a U.S.-based pharmaceutical company, part of Hoffmann LaRoche. The company will pool richly detailed genetic, medical, and genealogical information about Iceland's 270,000 residents into a set of databases, which it will then use to study the nature of disease. All residents of Iceland will be included in the study unless they opt out. Proponents of the plan, including the Parliament of Iceland, say it's widespread support among Iceland's population. They point to the benefits, which include the chance to study the unique genetic resources of a population that's both extremely homogeneous and historically isolated. These factors, they say, allow scientists to study genetic possibilities and effects in extreme detail. Proponents also say participants will be given free diagnostics or drugs developed from the program. But a growing number of scientists, doctors, and consumer advocates call the arrangement unethical and say the database could make the most private details of individuals' lives public. They say that free drugs amount to a tiny handout in exchange for giving up an extraordinary amount of privacy, and warn that insurance companies, employers, and others may use the information to discriminate. We're joined right now by three people. Dr. Ruth Hubbard is with us, Professor Emeritus of Biology at Harvard University. She's a board member of the Council for Responsible Genetics.
Andrew Kimbrell is in the studio with us in Washington, the director of the International Center for Technological Assessment. And Peter Hauksson joins us, chair of the Icelandic Mental Health Alliance and co-chair of Mannvernd, an association that was formed in opposition to the new law that allowed the government of Iceland to sell the genetic history of its population. And I have to say, this is a first for me, Peter Hauksson. I don't think I've ever spoken to anyone in Reykjavik, Iceland. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Why don't we start off with this sale of your country's entire genetic database to a corporation, ultimately, that's based in the U.S. Can you tell us how this happened?
Well, it is the result of a highly financed promotion campaign, which we have not been able to withstand. And the companies have succeeded in receiving great support from the government in the parliament. And the company is American-owned by American venture finance capitalist companies. It's not owned by Hofmeier-La Roche, but it's supported greatly by a contract with Hofmeier-La Roche.
No.
And, well, the support was greatest in the beginning when almost everyone supported it in the polls, but support rapidly went down when people heard of the risks inherent in being registered. So I think that was the cause of the great haste we saw in the last days in Parliament when great changes were made to the bill, which made it, in our opinion, even worse. Genetic information was included in the bill, and admission of other scientists to the database was restricted. So there was a great haste to pass the bill because the support was going down, I think.
Now, Peter Hauksson, can you explain what is so special about the Icelanders, your country's genetic population that makes it so unusual and so much in the interest of a U.S. corporation to have?
I think there are many things that are special with us, especially that we have a good health service with excellent medical records, and also we have genealogical information about Icelanders. We can trace our ancestry way back, and I think there are various things that make us special and profitable for a pharmaceutical company. And that's why they are so interested. I don't know if it's the genetic homogeneity that's so special. That has been doubted, and it has been called the theory of the blonde and blue-eyed genetics. But I don't know if that's true. The many benefits from the database have been proposed and promised, and I hope they will come true if the database will be created, but the benefits are not known. Only the risks are known, and they have been explained clearly by experts, data experts. Data is not protected sufficiently, according to experts. Personal data, especially in such a small country as this, people can be traced rather easily, and we feel that ethical principles are not adhered to because of this. And most important is that patients will not be asked for permission. There will be no informed consent, and there will be no way back once information about you is registered in the database. There will be no way of changing it or deleting it.
Andrew Kimbrell, let me bring in Andrew Kimbrell into this conversation. Peter Hauksson, director of the International Center for Technological Assessment. What do you see here in the case of Iceland?
It seems to me this is just a terrifying precedent. We really are seeing companies, corporations really around the world now sort of enclose the genetic commons. I mean, this is the genetic code of a country. It's something we assumed was something that would be the common heritage of that country. No one should own our genes. No one should be able to patent them. There shouldn't be a monopoly, as there is in this case, by a company on people's genes. Yes, it brings up these privacy questions that are discussed. I mean, do you want your insurance company to know about your genetic readout? Should your employer know about your genetic readout? Or shouldn't this be private information? I mean, once this becomes electronic data, I think most of us are pretty experienced with what happens to electronic data about your credit rating or other private details of your life. Now imagine that your genetic code with all your potential physical or mental genetic predispositions is available, and particularly to a corporation and theoretically to other corporations. Also, I think it's important for Americans to realize that this isn't just something that's happening in Iceland. You know, our Department of Defense is now collecting these DNA readouts on everybody who is an employee of the Department of Defense. Again, there is no guarantee whatsoever that the DNA is not going out to other government agencies, government, other parties. So these are millions of Americans that are going to be suffering the same kind of privacy problems, potential dangers as the people in Iceland. So
I think this is going to surprise people. What do you mean, every employee of the Department of Defense?
Department of Defense, they are doing a genetic readout of this is something that is, Council for Responsible Genetics and my group and others have been looking at this now for several years after a couple of soldiers said they just say no to having your genetic readout, captured by the Department of Defense for, and they were going to keep it stockpiled for 70 years, this information. So increasingly we're seeing corporations and government agencies get this kind of genetic information on us, and it could in the future be equivalent to what our Social Security number is now. Your genetic readout is something that's simply available to anybody for any purpose. And believe me, insurance companies and employers, this is very valuable information by which they can use to discriminate against you based on your genetic readout.
Ruth Hubbard, from your perspective as someone who's worked on the issue of science and the idea of science for the people, can you talk about what the Council for Responsible Genetics is doing about a situation like this?
Well, we are trying very hard to get people to understand, among other things, that it's not clear how much useful information will in fact be extracted. That is, genes are only a part, and usually a very small part, of the story. And yet, as far as the companies are concerned, they're extremely important, because on the basis of their DNA sampling, they will be able to develop predictive tests, so-called. And it's not clear that how predictive they are, in fact, but they can be sold. And they will also be able to produce drugs. And again, it's not clear how effective they will be. But as far as profit is concerned, the profit can be reaped irrespective of how useful this is to the individuals concerned. So I totally agree that the invasion of privacy is paramount. But what is also clear is that the motivation for this is financial, is economic, is monopolistic, and has very little to do with improving people's health, because it's not at all clear that there will be widespread benefits for health from any of this, because genes are always only part of the story. And going to a more homogeneous population like Iceland may be useful, but useful not even for the Icelanders probably, but surely not useful for the rest of us who do not come from, are not part of such homogeneous populations, and where it's not at all clear that whatever genes we may have in common with the Icelanders exert similar influences in people who have very different overall genetic constitutions and very different growth and other environmental experiences.
Hmm. Peter Hauksson, chair of the Icelandic Mental Health Alliance, can you talk about what your group is doing to educate the public about how it can protect itself from abuses of this information?
We're going to try to educate people, to inform people of the inherent dangers of being registered. We are going to tell people how they can prevent being registered. People can request not to be registered beforehand by sending such a request, a form, to the Surgeon General. If people have the presence of mind to make such an initiative, other people who do not have this presence of mind, they will be registered. So we think it's very important to help people, to inform people, and help them prevent being registered. And we hope to reach as many as possible.
Hmm. There was an op-ed piece in the New York Times by Richard Lewontin, a colleague of Ruth Hubbard's, who said some critics have objected that the medical needs of Icelanders and others would be better served if all biologists, not just those licensed by this company DECODE, had unrestricted access to the information in the database. Science, after all, usually makes better progress when information is freely shared. Andrew Kimbrell.
Yeah, I think, Amy, it's really important to put this in the context of what is really a worldwide gene rush by transnational corporations right now to patent the entire genome. That's all the genetic code, not only of human beings, but of virtually every living thing on Earth, from plants and animals. I mean, just like in the first age of colonialization, you know, people went in for the oil, for the fossil fuels of the third world. Now we are seeing these transnational corporations, you know, going around the world trying to find valuable genes that they can patent. That is monopoly ownership of the genetic code. And when a certain company owns a gene, whether it be the gene that's responsible for breast cancer or the genes that deal with human growth or a certain brain function, they have a monopoly control of that, which means that other people who want to do research on that, public institutions, cannot use those patented genes without paying high royalties to that corporation. So we are seeing, really, again, this incredible thing of the enclosure of genetic commons by corporations, which, far from helping research in health research and curing diseases, actually hurting it by making this genetic information privatized, giving it a monopoly control to a corporation, making it very difficult for other researchers, and particularly public institutions or small institutions without a lot of funding, to do the valuable research they need to do.
Well, we have to wrap up the discussion, but I want to give people a chance to get some phone numbers or websites. Why don't we begin with Peter Hauksson in Iceland. Can you give us a contact number for the Icelandic Mental Health Alliance and Mannvernd, the association formed in opposition of the new law that allows the government of Iceland to sell the genetic history?
Well, there is an excellent website.
That's good enough.
www.simnet.is/mannvernd. That's MANNVERND.
Okay, and we'll give that again tomorrow, www.simnet.is. Is/Mannvernd, MANNVERND. How about the, Andrew Kimbrell, the International Center for Technological Assessment?
This is www.icta.org.
And finally, Ruth Hubbard, the Council of Responsible Genetics.
I can give you a phone number.
Very
I'm
quick.
I don't have the
Very
website.
Quick. Very quick.
The phone number is 617-868-0870.
I want to thank you all very much for being with us, and that takes care of this show. Thanks to Maria Carrion, Jeremy Scahill, and Stephanie Donny, also Joe Gill, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.